KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, February 11th at 5:30 p.m. This will be a hybrid meeting. It will be held at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is...
Good morning. I'm one of the hosts on KABU's weekday morning folk strip. My name's Will. We lost one of our best DJs in December. Diane Carl hosted Early Morning Gumbo on Tuesdays for many years. Now we need help. We need new DJs for Tuesday mornings. One of them could be you or someone you know. Think about it. Are you interested in folk music? Each show takes time and effort, but it's fun. Nothing fancy, just be yourself and tell listeners about the music you play. Imagine hearing yourself on the radio. Most of us record our programs at home, but some come to the station. No experience required, KABU offers free training. If you're interested, please go to kboo.fm/volunteer on the internet to see what's involved. Thanks for helping.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is the best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, Trump orders his administration to begin preparations on a detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay to house up to 30,000 migrants. Also, we'll feature a Gaza update from Ziad Abbas, Executive Director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening. listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, President Donald Trump ordered his administration to begin preparations on a detention facility at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to house up to 30,000 migrants detained for being in the U.S. without legal authorization. Trump signed a presidential memorandum instructing the Defense Department and Department of Homeland Security to expand an existing migrant center at Guantanamo Bay, which has long been used to hold suspects accused in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Trump provided few details, but it would house, it, he said, the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people. This is where we're starting, and we have a lot to talk about. As I said, joining us is Andrea Carmen. We're honored to have her. She's the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. She's just back from Guatemala. And also joining us is our contributing correspondent for legal affairs, Camilo Perez Bustillo. Camilo is part of the leadership of the Witness at the Border group, coordinating with the NLG's Task Force on the Americas. Welcome to both of you. A lot going on. Let me just start with you, Camilo. This is extraordinary. We're talking about now many flights housing 30,000 more folk at Guantanamo, and this means lots of flights in and around Cuba. What you know, is this the beginning of the Cuban invasion? We've been hearing about the potential taking back of the Panama Canal. So what's your analysis, and what should we be thinking here?
Thank you, Dennis. And I want to extend my solidarity, my greeting and respect to Andrea and to the International Treaty Council for the extraordinary work they've been doing for 40 years on these issues. I want to, I guess, underline two things. You know, bottom line, I think the headline for us is MAGA has no borders and we shouldn't have any borders either in how we think about and approach these issues. You know, there's a lot of talk, of course, about the need for rapid response in the U.S. to the, you know, to the mass raids and terror that's being sown in our community, including, of course, indigenous nations within the U.S., you know, both in Navajo territory and the Mescalero Apache territory, et cetera. Andrea can you know, I'm sure, fill us in about all of that. But the bottom line is this affects everybody globally, but specifically there's an extension of Trump's war against migrants, his domestic war against migrants, to the hemisphere. Guantanamo, the news about Guantanamo has to be understood in that context. It's also important to stress, you know, a lot of us know about Guantanamo post 9/11, as you mentioned. You know, at the height, there were approximately 800 supposed terrorists being held there under systematic conditions of torture that were documented and denounced by every major human rights organization in the world, the UN, et cetera, and which proceeded with impunity. At this point, there's only 15 left. But so when we think about Trump today talking about, as he signed the Lake and Riley Act, right, talking about maybe detaining as many as 30,000, there's never been a detention camp of that size on the territory that's currently occupied illegally by the U.S., including a major military base. So there's a question there about, you know, logistically, how are they going to pull this off, assuming they do? But there's also some historical precedents we have to have in mind. Number one, long before Guantanamo was used to house, disappear, and torture hundreds of those suspected for their relation to 9/11, it was used in the 1980s, not so long ago, to house Cuban and Haitian migrants who were described back then as, quote, boat people, who were intercepted on small crafts on the high seas in international waters by the U.S. military, including the Coast Guard, and warehoused and abused at Guantanamo. So this is not the first time Guantanamo will be used as a migrant detention center, but there's another layer to this as well, which has to do, again, with the hemispheric dimensions of MAGA. Let's think about it that way. There's been the pushback that we talked about earlier this week in this space by Colombia, by Mexico, by Honduras, by Brazil, about the military deportation flights and the torture, the abuse, the mistreatment of people who were being deported on those flights. And we saw how President Petro of Colombia pushed back, and to other, you know, varying degrees, how Brazil officially complained, how Honduras began to push back and say, well, we've got a military base here from the U.S. in Honduras, and maybe we'll rethink the presence of that military base, and maybe we'll, you know, refresh our ties to China, you know, thinking along those lines. And Mexico, which pushed back in terms of the use of its airspace for military deportation flights. So we have to connect those dots, and we have to understand that when the U.S. starts making noises through the new Trump administration about, for example, retaking the Panama Canal, opening up this migration detention center at Guantanamo is part of the same line of thinking. This means we have to understand a basic equation, which is Marco Rubio's agenda as the new viceroy for the empire in Latin America, because that's his role, as the global enforcer of MAGA. What he is doing is putting into operation the equation that tells us that Monroe Doctrine plus Manifest Destiny equals MAGA's neo-imperial agenda for this hemisphere. And that's yes. where we need to begin. Guantanamo's at the heart of that. From the perspective of the revolutionary Cuban government, since 1959, the Guantanamo military base operated by the U.S. has illegally occupied that portion of Cuban territory. From Cuba's perspective, that base is equivalent to, let's say, the West Bank, from the perspective of the Palestinian liberation movement. So from a Cuban liberation perspective, this would intensify the current illegal occupation and invasion of Cuban territory. This would constitute, in effect, yet an additional act of aggression and war against Cuba, and would become a staging ground inevitably for the noose that Marco Rubio and Donald Trump want to tighten around the throats of the Cuban people. And so we need to stand up and we need to push back.
Absolutely. That's the voice of Camilo Perez Bustillo. He is part of the leadership of Witness at the Border, and he's a coordinator of the National Lawyers Guild Task Force on the Americas, joining us. And we are honored to have you, Andrea Carmen, from, I believe you're back in Tucson. You're just back from Guatemala. There's a lot to talk about at many levels, including Plan Sonora and all that stuff. But I've got to get your take on, first of all, how's the atmospheric pressure feel in Tucson? And give us a sense of your response to all of this happening. It's like life in the age of Trump now.
Yes, and thank you for your kind words, both of you, for the work of the International Indian Treaty Council. I just wanted to make a comment, you know, kind of pushing back on Trump, which we do in many, many ways. But we hear 45 minutes from the so-called border between the United States and Mexico do not feel threatened by so-called undocumented immigrants in any way, shape, or form. But the fear level and the threat level in a place like Tucson, Arizona, and on our Pascua Yaqui Reservation and on the Tono Awesome Reservation, right here on the border, in our traditional homeland, by the way, you know, where we know we're not immigrants from anywhere, is very fearful. And a lot of families where our nation, as you probably know, we have 8 traditional communities in Sonora, Mexico, and 6 here in Arizona. So for us, you know, our families are from both sides. My husband is from Rio Yaqui, Sonora, Mexico. My grandmother was born in Licam, Sonora, Mexico. There are a lot of families that would be considered mixed, I guess you could say, in terms of, you know, the outside view, the settler view, the colonizer's view of immigration status, you know, on our own homeland. So a lot of families are very worried and fearful for what's going to happen to indigenous peoples. The word has gone out among all the tribal nations, you know, carry your tribal ID card, carry, you know, whatever you have. But there's a lot of our own nation members who are here without those documents, and they live peacefully, you know, in families and have kids. And there's a lot of fear and concern here, and we're getting a lot of calls in our Tucson office from a lot of different people asking, you know, what should they do? What will they do? You know, if the immigration forces come in, and then we're hearing, you know, all this about Guantanamo and deportation to wherever they can take you, not even back to the country where, you know, we have, you know, some staff and people we work with who are what they call DACA, you know, dreamers. And you know, some of them are university graduates here, University of Arizona, living here for as long as they can remember. And they're concerned about what's going to happen. Nobody's being clear what's going to happen with the DACA young people either. So there's a lot of concern, a lot of anxiety and stress here, right here in Tucson, Arizona. So I just wanted to bring that out, that, you know, we aren't afraid of immigrants. We're afraid of ICE and the Trump administration's crazy plans. Like you say, I just got back from the 4th International Indigenous Women's Symposium on Environmental Violence. And I'll go into some of the things we talked about. But there was a lot of fear and concern in Guatemala among the indigenous people because of the threats to invade Panama, you know, right next door.
Talk more about that. Talk about, you were just down south, you were in Guatemala, but tell us a little bit about that and about, you know, the panic, because that's clearly the idea. I also want to ask you, are you noticing, is it more obvious? Are there more police, feds in the streets? Is there more activity? Or is it still at the level of fanning the flames? How do you see it now? What does it look like? Are things changing?
We were right on
obviously?
The outskirts of Guatemala City, and at night you could hear the gunfire around. And it wasn't like in the past where it was actually the, you could say, authorized military that carried out the genocide against indigenous peoples in the 1980s and 90s there. But there's a lot of, you could say, paramilitary. There are a lot of troops that are actually funded by corporations there, mining interests, agribusiness, and there's a lot of violence there. So the people are already on edge. But then the threat of a U.S. invasion, when they already went through a United States-backed genocide with U.S. tax dollars and U.S. military training about how to torture people, and more than 400 entire indigenous villages were wiped out in the 1980s and 90s. So, you know, that anxiety factor has never left the indigenous peoples there. But now there's a whole new level of threat of a U.S. invasion of Central America. No one can say it's not going to happen, or it's just idle talk or a threat to get better negotiations or whatever. But, you know, you got to believe it when Trump says he's going to do something. He's at least going to try it. Even the feeble resistance in the U.S. system, you know, may or may not be able to stop him. No one's saying anything about illegally sending U.S. Army troops, is what we're hearing, you know, to the border in Mexico. I mean, that's not supposed to be able to happen within the borders of the United States. But it's happening. Who's calling a halt to this. You know, where are the people from his own party or the court? You know, at least a judge stopped, you know, some of the things most recently. But, you know, he's talking about deporting American Indians, too, who were here first. And, you know, he's the immigrant, and so is his family. So, there's just a lot of concern, and it seems like another crazy thing comes out of his mouth every 10 minutes. But people are taking it seriously, and they're worried. They really are about what's going to happen next. But I want to bring in something, like you mentioned, the Plan de Sonora, because this is something I talked with Miguel about, too. You know, they're sending, you know, troops along the border in New Mexico, and this is National Guard right now in Arizona. But 2 years ago was announced at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change Conference of the Parties in Egypt. It happened then in a press conference between the foreign minister of the government of Mexico and John Kerry, Ambassador John Kerry, the climate czar for the United States, the representative of Biden at that time, about investing more than $40 billion from the U.S. in turning the Sonora Desert right on the other side of the so-called border, our territory, and the territory of the Tonotam and the Apata, the Lipan Apache, and others that live on the Mexico side, we have to say, into one giant lithium mine. And this is, you know, the danger of Elon Musk's role, the king of lithium. And just to say that lithium mining in the desert uses tons and tons of groundwater, contaminates groundwater for up to 300 years, and it travels up to 150 miles. And a bird drinking out of those lithium, you know, processing ponds, they say one sip and it falls over dead. So this is, you know, this is our life that's being put on the line here with giant investment in the name of green energy and climate mitigation. It's totally false solutions, and all of this is tied in, and we're really concerned that with troops, American troops along the border, and all this lithium in our territories right on the other side of the border, you know, what's really the plan here? What's the plan de Sonora? It might go beyond just investment in a bunch of lithium mines that's going to destroy our water and our way of life. It might be more than that if you think about it.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we definitely want to be thinking about it. That's the voice of Andrea Carmen. She's Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council. Also along with us is Camilo Perez Bustillo, and we've been talking about the militarization at the border, the movement of tens of thousands of troops. They have to be getting the troops ready because they're already planning airlifts, as we reported earlier, to Guantanamo. Trump is talking about some 30,000 people being deported. It does feel, Camilo, Andrea, that the action in terms of the deportation and the criminalizations are, in a sense, I guess it's obvious. It's the first part of the ethnic cleansing, so that they can go wild and not have anybody get in the way of their lithium party. But of course, Andrea, you must know we saw a massive fire up here that people are still recovering just south of Santa Cruz. You know, when people were sort of eating metal, walking around with metallic flavors in their mouth and running for their lives. So this is a very dangerous moment, isn't it?
It's a very dangerous moment. And I will say that we had some very powerful ceremonies led by women spiritual leaders, cultural religious leaders from the Mayan peoples, who are very strong. And it helped us to remember what our ancestors endured and survived, and why we still have our traditional ways, and keeping the message and the wisdom and the courage of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers, and what they left for us, and what we have to do to continue that struggle forward. So I'm coming back very concerned. We heard a lot of you know, terrible stories. We heard from women from Guam, for example, in the Pacific, that are still recovering from the nuclear testing, as well as indigenous women from New Mexico who are facing a renewed uranium mining in the name of clean energy, if you can believe that. So these links that we're having, agro-business, you know, highly toxic chemicals and pesticides being used, but you know, we united with one voice. We want to support each other. We had 60 women from more than 20 countries in all seven regions. We even had a indigenous representative from Siberia in Russia that we work very closely with. She's the co-chair of our indigenous caucus at the climate change UN work. And, you know, hearing from what's going on there, if you can imagine that kind of repression, and there's already so many indigenous leaders from the Russia region who are in exile, and it's happening all over the world, but the United States is right in the middle of it. And we found out that the United States military is the single largest environmental polluter on the planet with all of their military waste, their weapons testing. We heard from women from Puerto Rico where it's treated like a national sacrifice colony for bomb testing. And, you know, we are hearing some very serious and tragic stories, you know, birth defects and cancer and, you know, all of these things happening. But at the same time, it strengthens us to come together and, you know, remember in ceremony and remember by knowing our history, what we're capable of indigenous people, as indigenous peoples, of surviving, you know, the most brutal colonization. But we don't want to go through that again, but it may be happening already. It may be happening now.
Is there, are people, I mean, again, you're talking to us from Tucson, and the threats are flowing from Washington. There have been some reports of young people being stopped. I'm wondering if there are preparations being made, if young people are being advised or being counseled. I'm wondering if the fear factor is already way up, particularly among young people.
Absolutely, it is. But there's also, you know, organizations here, and we plan to actually, you know, have some Know Your Rights workshops for, you know, some of the tribal nations here. But I just want to bring out one example. You know, the Taino peoples from the Caribbean are part of the International Nin Treaty Council. They sit on our board of directors. And one of their leaders from New York told me just today that there was an ICE raid in Newark, New Jersey, and they rounded up a whole bunch of the workers in a seafood packing plant. But they also took into custody a Puerto Rican representative, a man, a young man, who was actually a military, U.S. military veteran. And he showed his veteran's card, and they didn't believe him. They took him and held him for a lot of hours along with the other detainees. But Roberto said his boss said they only went after the brown-skinned people. They were, you know, light-skinned people, blonde people working in there. I guess they're not interested in Norwegian illegal immigrants, are they, you know? They only went after the brown people and the workers, and they took a lot of them into custody, whether or not they could show that they were U.S. citizens. So we do see it as a type of ethnic cleansing, and it's happening even on some of the Indian reservations already. The Navajo tribal chairman has come out and said that some of the Navajo Nation citizens have been detained. And, you know, where is it going to stop is the question. You know, where is it going to stop? What is the real plan here? You know, we're looking at this Plan de Sonora and the largest lithium deposit in the world in Sonora, Mexico. And what is the real plan here? Are the deportations just an excuse to take Sonora, Mexico, you know, because of all the lithium? I mean, I think we just have to be prepared for anything, really, at this point, and, you know, keep strong and keep resisting.
And Camilla, are you still with us? Final comments?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Please, just a final response to all that we just heard. Very troubling. But Andreas, obviously, it's important what we hear from you. And what do you think, Camilla? How do we make sense of this and make it a part of the flow?
I think it's just critical. Everything we've heard and everything that you know, what we heard implies about the scope of the challenge we face. And just to echo, you know, a couple of the points that Andrea made so powerfully. One is that when we see the headlines about the deportation flights, and when we talk about, let's say, Mexico pushing back, and whether it has or not, or how much it will, and whether Mexico will be acting in solidarity with migrants in transit who are returned or who are persecuted and, you know, subjected to abuse on Mexican territory, in part by Mexican troops and National Guard armed and trained by the U.S. What we have to remember is that everything Trump is doing, is unleashing against migrants in the U.S. necessarily goes across borders. And so again, that's why the indigenous perspective is so crucial and so central, because indigenous peoples throughout Latin America and the world, but throughout the Americas, have been exercising an ancestral right to freedom of movement for millennia. Way before the settler colonial states that currently exist or the colonial empires that preceded them existed. And so that's an ancestral right, that's a fundamental expression of indigenous self-determination and ultimately liberation. And that's what we need to absorb, emulate, respect, act in solidarity with, and incorporate into the struggles of what's sometimes referred to as the immigrant rights movement, but which is really a movement in defense of human rights, and understanding that human rights by definition have no borders, because the whole point is that you have rights as a human being, and for example as a member of a indigenous nation, that states can neither give nor take away. And what we have to understand too is that the challenges to all of this on U.S. territory extend to Mexican territory, and we have to wait and see what position Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum will take in terms of solidarity, not just, quote-unquote, with migrants from other countries, but migrants from Mexico itself. And there are a lot of questions about that. There's a lot of terror on Mexican territory from Sonora to Chiapas, from north to south, in places like Oaxaca, and throughout the Mexican territory, against indigenous human rights defenders, against environmental defenders, against women. Okay. And all of that continues as we speak, and that's part of the challenge that we need to address.
Okay, we're going to leave it there, but Camilo, Andrea, we're going to count on the work that you're doing. We want to continue this dialogue. We want to let people know what's going on beyond the corporate press. They're all upset about that Trump degraded a general who probably led charges against Vietnamese folks, but anyway, they didn't express much interest in the Guantanamo thing. Maybe they'll pick it up later. We thank both of you, Andrea Carmen, Executive Director, International Indian Treaty Council, just back from Guatemala, Camilo Perez Basilio, our really sort of our regular correspondent on understanding all of this. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints, and you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It's your daily investigative news magazine. We're going to take a break.
Version now, 1961 version, Manteca. Sell that. and take care.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. This is over Free Speech Radio that you're listening, KPFA Pacifica in the Bay Area. And it's the People's Radio Network. We're happy to have you along today. And every day we start today back in Gaza, actually, with our good friend Ziad Abbas. He is the executive director of the Middle East Children's Alliance. He comes from the West Bank, and the Middle East Children's Alliance works very closely with folks in Gaza and the West Bank. Ziad, welcome back to Flashpoints. I have to ask you, I was watching some of the goings-on, the streaming of people back into Gaza through the destruction, but the excitement, it's extraordinary. In the face of the destruction, the people are heading back, and they're all determined to make once again a new Gaza. What's going through your mind as you see this?
Yeah, thank you for having me, Dennis. Absolutely. Yeah, the last 2 days, we are witnessing a historical moment in the Palestinian history, watching the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians returning back to their towns, cities, refugee camps, or their homes. Even I don't, the moment when we say homes, because most of them, they already lost their homes. All these houses destroyed, but the people, they are insisting to return back. It's mixed feeling. Me personally witnessing this and watching since the beginning, and hundreds of thousands of people, children, women, all people, all the generation, they carry what they can and they try to go back. And even watching, like, some people, they return back to Jabalia refugee camp, which many reports we heard about Jabalia refugee camp, how they destroyed totally the whole refugee camp. But people, they find difficulties to find where are used to be their homes. And they are taking the streets. They have their own tents. They are trying to find a way where they can survive, waiting for other support and relief to come with tents, caravans, whatever it's possible for them. It's a historical day, mixed feeling. People of Gaza sacrifice a lot, and still the number of the martyrs increasing, because every day they are found like more bodies under the rubble of the houses destroyed, because there are certain areas that the people, they couldn't reach, but right now they are with the ceasefire, they are able, and every day there are like between 15 to 30. The first few days they were a huge number, and right now the people there, they don't have these kind of tools and equipments and big machines to clean the rubble and find the bodies. We are expected the numbers to increase. Right now 47,537 people, they are already bodies killed in Gaza Strip, but every day this number is increasing. At the same time that the people, they are insisting for the Palestinian people, there are many statements coming from the people. They are walking yesterday and today. They say this is our small return, because in their mind, in their spirit, they believe there is a bigger return when they return back someday to their villages and cities inside Palestine, inside 1948 area, which their parents and their grandparents, they were uprooted in 1948. Absolutely, this is like, for the people in Gaza, this is a huge thing. And you can see that the people at the same time, not just going back to their houses, they are going to reconnect with their families, relatives, neighbors. Some of them, they are going back to find the bodies of their relatives. They were killed, and their bodies under the rebels. Mixed feelings, sadness and joy, and devastation, frustration, and hope. All these kind of feelings coming together. For me as a Palestinian, the same. It's an amazing moment to watch and witness this moment. And we love to be with the people there. I know our staff members, they are in the ground. and they are supporting in this moment, and they are working there. But even for us, we wish all of us there to help and support rebuilding Gaza. And I believe that coming a few days, more people, they will be able to return back. It's still very difficult in Gaza Strip. Still, whatever is coming, that the aid coming to Gaza, it's not enough. People right now, it's very cold in Gaza, especially at night. And still the people, they need a lot of help and a lot of support. But yesterday and today, it's a remarkable day in the history of the Palestinian people, in the history of the human being, I can say, for all over the world. Who was expected this is what will happen right now after 471 days, ongoing genocide, and all the goals to uproot these people and throw them out of Palestine. Instead, they are able to return back to the rubble of their destroyed houses. And this is why I say for all humanity, for all the people in the world, to watch for this. And we are still learning. And people in Gaza, they are teaching a lot of lessons of steadfastness and resiliency and what it means for them, the meaning of home, land, and insisting this is their land, they are not going out, they are not leaving.
That's the voice of Ziad Abbas of the Middle East Children's Alliance. We're talking about the flood of Palestinians, of Gazans heading back to Gaza, moving during this ceasefire. Now, we're hearing that the trucks are flowing again, hundreds of trucks. We're hearing as many as 500 trucks a day. I'm wondering what you're hearing from the folks you work with on the ground in terms of stuff getting through, what people still desperately need. Are there crews yet? I hate to be so, ask such a difficult question. Are there crews now digging through the rubble, trying to see who's missing? I'm wondering how they're keeping track of who's missing besides the actual body count that they have. Sorry to ask these hard questions. Yeah. But go on, please.
Yes. Regarding the aid, yes, absolutely. There are a lot of trucks coming. There are between 500 to 600. It's not a clear numbers. But there are more trucks coming into Gaza. There are more aid coming to Gaza. But it's not enough. There are a lot of things that the people in Gaza, they are missing right now. The people, they need tents. They need a place to sleep. They need a place to be to feel warm, especially for these children. But the people, they are trying. People, as we say in the past, during the bombing time, and the people, they survive in Gaza Strip on their luck, where they are, where they will be. And they are surviving on the collective spirit they have it there, where the people, they support each other, try to take care of each other, open whatever they have, houses, the shelters, the tents, they share everything in Gaza Strip. And this is other reason, like how the people, they having this cheering up and feel like they are together on this as a community. Absolutely, there are a lot of things is missing for them, like hygiene kits. They need this kind of big machine. They come to clear and to clean the rubble. We speak about over 92,000 tons of rubble, need years to clean up. But they need to start, because there are still some bodies. If they are not tens of thousands, over 10,000, maybe I can say thousands of people. And there are still many people they are missing, because some people, they don't know their relative, their brother, their husbands, and they are still alive, or they are killed under the rebels, or they are arrested inside Israeli jail. Until now, they don't have a clear list about who is arrested in Gaza. Maybe later during this negotiation with the ceasefire, they will find out who is inside the prison. But still, there are bodies under the rebels, and people, they are searching for that. And the people, they speak about it, actually. There were many reports while the people, they are walking back. And they ask them, they say it very clear, we are going back to find our home. We want to find our relatives. We want to have them speak about part of their families. Many women, they were speaking about their husband, their children, their brothers, that they are still under their rubbles and their bodies not found yet. They are still considered unknown where they are. And of course, the other, like you find fathers speaking about their children, their wives. Part of these families, they are still there. And yes, every day they are searching and they are looking in different areas. And just to be more clear, people, they are not allowed to get to every area in the north, or even in the middle area near Nusayrat, near Bridge Camp. Still some areas they are not allowed to go there. And even in Rafah area near what we call it Salah al-Din, but Philadelphia zone, that the people, they are not able to get close to find out who's still, somebody's still there. So it will take some time. It will take some days and maybe weeks and maybe months until they will be able to clean up. You speak about 471 days. They didn't stop only for 1 week during November, short pause, and still right now there are somebody's still under the shovels. And hospitals, like right now the reports coming about the hospitals, which they are destroyed mostly. Still some hospitals, they are able to do some services. Some of the stuff got into the hospital, but it's not enough. I can't say the life returned back to get the specialty to the hospital. You speak about one of the famous hospitals. Today I was reading a report about it, and I heard from my colleague too, in the ground. They were speaking about 95% of that hospital already destroyed, and many other hospitals inside Gaza City and inside the middle area in the south. These hospitals need some time to rebuild. Right now, we feel the most necessary thing to have a mobile hospital, temporary hospital, where they can sit up and try to help the people. And we have over 110,000 people that are injured. You speak about 10,000 of them still need the treatment. And you speak about between 13,000 to 14,000 injured people, they need the treatment outside Gaza Strip, because it's impossible for them to get the treatment they need to survive inside Gaza Strip. And the people, they are not allowed to travel outside Gaza still. And they didn't open the borders where the people, they can get in or leave for a treatment in Gaza. We hope soon with this ceasefire, they will be able to do that. And every day, every hour, there is a new things that people, they are discovering inside Gaza. Discovering about what it means to live for 471 days. What it means, like, not just the destroying of the building, the streets, the infrastructure, the electricity, the water, all these kinds of stuff. Like, they need to survive there. But it's about the human being, about the people. They are learn about each other. They're their relatives. My colleague, Wafa, I remember the first day of the ceasefire. She was scared to go outside of the house because during this period, she was working all the time, tried just to focus to do the work, to help her family, her community, and do the work we are doing in Gaza. She said, right now, I want to go back as a human being without bombing, but I want to discover who I lost from my relatives, my friends, who will be to find out who is disappeared. They are not exist anymore. They are killed. They are buried, etc. And this is like, we call it the shock after the ceasefire. The shock is still like coming inside Gaza. These people, like everyone in Gaza, traumatized through this, the survival, which some of them, they describe it. It's a miracle they survived 471 days of ongoing genocide. But for them right now, it's like the earthquake after the shock, what we call it. There is another shock and another shaking to find out what is hidden under the rubbles in Gaza Strip, and how many people they were killed, the amount of the destruction inside Gaza Strip. Still, the people of Gaza, they try to find out. The other thing,
it's amazing.
You see the other thing, you can see the collective spirit in Gaza, the bride inside the people, in their eyes, in their, they are crying, but you see their shoulder. They are very proud who they are. And they are survived this, and they are refusing to leave Gaza Strip. They are insisting and connected to that part of the land, connected to their homes, even the rebels. And to be honest with you, it reminds me with the Nakba generation, 1948. Little they know, most of their houses destroyed, but they still having the keys of their houses. And I still have the key, like most of the Palestinian refugees, which we are close to 8 million Palestinian refugees right now, between the people they are registered in the UN and people they are not registered in the UN. I'm speaking about Palestinian refugees, they were uprooted in 1948.
You still have the keys, that's what you said, right?
Absolutely.
To the houses of 19...
I have the key. I have the key of my parents' destroyed house with me here in the United States. And, of course, many others, too, here in the United States, they have the keys of their destroyed houses. And, of course, yes, in Palestine, most of the refugees they have. What I want to say with that, that all the displaced people, they are moving right now, try to allocate. And even for us, for our work, we are trying, like today. And I give a credit to the people of Gaza, how much they are fast. Like we have in Gaza City, we had 2 days ago 2 major big water system working in solar panel, working to help the people to get the clean water. We decided immediately 2 days ago we want to have another water system. And this is the credit, like even people carrying the whole equipment walking, because the cars or trucks cannot enter every area, and they succeed to have another water system. By the end of the day today, the third water system is working. People are trying. They are doing some improvement because they want to survive. They want to access. They want to take care of each other. And yeah, I feel like today, like this good news is coming from the ground. I know it's not good enough, because good enough is to end this in Gaza Strip, to end not just the war. The genocide did not stop by the ceasefire. I want to remind the listeners, genocide did not stop while the Israelis stopped their war machine. Genocide is still going on, because the people, they are still suffering. Hundreds of thousands of people, they are still sick. One of the people yesterday, a man, he was walking for like over like 5 miles. He collapsed and he died while he's trying to return back. He was tired. The way how the Israelis destroyed the roads, and by ordering the people to, especially the first day, to walk back to the north, it's another kind of torture. But the people, they take it because they implemented that because they want to show, and they are like missing the north of Gaza, Gaza Strip, Gaza City.
It's amazing. And people are walking for miles. People are walking for miles, aren't they? They're carrying their fathers and their sons and their children and their mothers on their back, and they're walking for miles and miles. And they have one object in mind, and that's to get home, even if it's in dust. It is an extraordinary sight. I want to ask you a little bit about what's going on in the West Bank. You know a great deal about the West Bank. The Israelis are, while people are focusing on Gaza, and they need to be, there's a lot of violence and there's a lot of activity by the soldiers working in concert with the settlers. So I'm sure you're hearing a lot about that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking with you on the still Jenin refugee camp and Jenin city, under huge attack. This is the 9th day for them, because right now it's early morning in Palestine time. This is the 9th day. We have 16 people killed in Jenin on the 9th day since the Israelis start this kind of escalation against the people there. And actually right now, like even less than an hour ago, there were huge clashes that happened in the east part, east neighborhood of Jenin city. And of course, in Jenin, what they are doing, it's not that much different what they did in Jabalia refugee camp and many parts of Gaza Strip. They are using the same way with their bulldozers. They are attacking the refugee camp, destroy the infrastructure. We have over 100 houses, they are already destroyed. And that's not just they are destroying the houses. They even they set fire inside these houses. And they are using different kind of a huge bulldozers, changing the geography inside this refugee camp. The same. I'm speaking about Jenin City, Jenin refugee camp. You speak about Tulkarem. This is the second day. Tulkarem City, Tulkarem refugee camp, Nur Shams refugee camp, and many villages around Jenin and many villages around Tulkarem in the north of West Bank. This is what they are doing. They shot a Palestinian. They killed him in Tulkarem today. He's 23 years old. His name is Naji. He deserves to mention his name. His name is Naji, Ayman Naji, to be more clear. And there are two Palestinians yesterday. They were assassinated by the drone inside Tulkarem. And the way how they are, this is like systematic destruction. They mean it. They plan it that the people, they will be, it's difficult for them to live in their houses. They are destroying houses in Tulkarem City. And you have thousands of people, they are already displaced in Jenin refugee camp. And today, the people from Tulkarem refugee camp displaced. Even yesterday in Jenin refugee camp, actually, some people, they tried to return back. So they've destroyed houses or burned houses, but the Israelis, they opened fire and they shot some of them, 14 people, they were injured. This is ongoing. When I say the ongoing genocide did not stop in Gaza, because what's going on there for 471 days and the impact on the people in their daily lives there and in the West Bank and of course the rest of West Bank today. In Tawar refugee camp near Hebron, in Hebron City, in Nablus, in Bethlehem, and many other villages where settlers, they are lashing everywhere. And today, actually, that the settlers, they were attacking and protected by the Israeli army. And here when we speak about the settlers, they are attacking that the Palestinian villages and Palestinian, like especially crossing the roads, they are protected by soldiers. And of course, there were over 800 checkpoints in West Bank. Right now, it's over 1,000. You have gates on villages, the main entrances of villages, cities, like Bethlehem, my city. And they have only two entrances for the people to enter Bethlehem and leave. And of course, it's controlled by the Israeli army. And they are arresting a lot of people in Jenin refugee camp, in Tulkarem. And in that area, actually, I can speak about hundreds of people, they are already arrested. And of course, in other cities in West Bank. And Jerusalem, of course, it's not separate from that, where Israeli army, almost every, in the old city, they are almost in every street, make it difficult for the people, the students to move or anything there. And for all the Palestinian prisoners, they were released during the ceasefire. They are not allowed to celebrate. This is how Israel right now. They are fighting the Palestinian every level. They are fighting the Palestinian and taking their land. They are attacking their camps, set fire in their homes, destroy their houses, military checkpoints, and even they don't want the Palestinian people to have certain kind of happiness. They are attacking the houses of tens of prisoners. They were released in the exchange of prisoners and not to have any kind of celebration. That the mom, she's not allowed to be happy that to welcome her son. Some of them, they were in jail over 38 years. Some of them 30 years, 25, 20 years. They don't want the people to have any kind of celebration or relatives or friends to go visit, to celebrate with the people. And Palestinians, in general, they don't celebrate because this, the huge number of sacrifices that was happened in Gaza Strip. But people, they want to have this kind of moment. I still, when I was young, I remember when the exchange of prisoners was in 1985, how everyone in my camp, they were in the main street welcoming the buses of the prisoners during the exchange in that period. Right now, Israel tried to confiscate this moment from the Palestinian people, from Palestinian families, from the prisoners themselves, that this kind of happiness. But still, the people, they can try to manage around it and to deal with it. But how Israel is reaching out? West Bank is another plan. It's another scary time. And to be honest with you, everything right now depends how this is fire, how long it will last. People, they have their own feelings. They are worried about it. At the same time, people worry about this bank. What will happen with West Bank? What will happen with the people in the north of West Bank? And if they will be able to survive, or there is another plan? And people waiting to see what is the result of this visit. If Netanyahu coming to meet Trump here in the United States next week, what is the plan? How this will impact them?
Yeah. Ziad, how do people get in touch with you, get in touch with Mecca, learn more about what's going on?
Yeah, the people, they can go to our website, meccaforpeace.org, and they can learn about the work we are doing. We are still working, and now actually we are working in full capacity in the ground with all the relief from water, from the food distribution, our kitchen aid, clinics. We are still working there in very strong way, and people, they can come and support. At the same time, people, they can learn about solidarity movement here, what they have in the program, by going to the ARAC, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, within in San Francisco, or the Palestinian Youth Movement here in Bay Area, Jewish Voice for Peace. They can learn about the activities and solidarity activities here in Bay Area.
Thank you, Ziad. We always appreciate the very important information that you share with us, that we get around the corporate mainstream, which has censored this story all the way through. So thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Stay safe, Ziad. We'll talk to you soon.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Earth Angel, will you be mine?